Lords, ladies and gentlemen, a very warm welcome on behalf of the Dean and Chapter. Welcome to Westminster Abbey, and in particular to this glorious space of the Henry VII Chapel, also known as the Lady Chapel or the Order of the Bath Chapel, depending possibly on which side of the Reformation you stand, or all of the above if we are Anglican. The lecture on the Reformation tonight is on the Reformation and indeed on its consequences and legacy for social order, political life, democracy. And this is part of the autumn programme of the Westminster Abbey Institute, a body of the Abbey established especially to nourish and help revitalise moral and spiritual values in public life. Our speaker is Professor Alec Ryrie, and I think we're extraordinarily fortunate to have him here tonight. He will have been so much in demand, especially over these particular days of Reformation commemoration, prompted, of course, by the anniversary of Luther's 95 Theses. In demand, first and foremost, I suppose, because he is a professor of the history of Christianity at Durham, specializing in the Reformation, and he's published extensively, as you'll see, on the subject. But also because of his particular way of dealing with it, which is penetrating, it's lucid, it's engaging, and above all, for our purposes, keenly aware of this wider topography of the Reformation. That is, concerned how its ramifications did not just affect ecclesial issues, understood in a tightly focused way, or ecclesial theology, but also wider public life and order, something which fits so well into the concerns of the Westminster Abbey Institute. The title of Professor Ryrie's recent book, Protestants, the Radicals Who Made the Modern World, and the title of this lecture, Protest and Liberty, How the Reformation Shaped Modern Democracy, both give a good indication of this concern, which is so apposite for us here tonight in this Institute lecture. In history, as in contemporary life, we shall no doubt find that these consequences of the Reformation have not all been intended. The law of unintended consequences holds true for pretty much all of life, I suspect. But that is what makes life so interesting, and we shall be in extraordinarily good hands tonight for this lecture. Just a few housekeeping notices before I hand over. Obviously, if you would please silence any mobile devices. If for any reason we have to leave rather quickly, simply do as the marshals say and indicate, and they will get us out of here swiftly and safely. But now, please, a warm welcome for Professor Alec Ryrie.
Many thanks, and thank you to the Institute for this extraordinary invitation. So as a guest of the Institute, I'm charged with your moral and spiritual renewal. Well, let's see what we can do. When we celebrate historical anniversaries, we are usually telling stories not about the past, but about ourselves. And this year's quincentenary of Luther's 95 Theses, which sparked the Protestant Reformation, is a historical event which has always been too important to be left to historians. But what does it mean in our era, in a world which, at least in our corner of it, is more secular than ever before? Well, the way that a secular society celebrates a religious revolution is by transposing religion into a secular key and asking what our secular world owes to it. And given what obsesses our secular world at the moment, that means politics. So, what has the Reformation and the many-headed Protestant movements that it launched meant politically? There are two conventional stories that you can tell about this. Both of these stories are true. But the main thing that I want to suggest this evening is that they are not the whole truth, and that, in fact, they can come dangerously close to missing the point of the Protestant Reformation and what's followed from it entirely. And so, having briefly laid out those two stories for you, I want then to spend more time on a third, a hidden story of Protestantism and politics, a story which has actually shaped a great deal of the last five centuries and is very much doing so around the world today. And I think it's significant partly as a matter of understanding, but also because I think for many of us in our culture it's an unsettling story. But it may possibly have something to say to some of our modern troubles. But first, the conventional stories. The first one is one of defiance and revolution. This is a story told in slightly different forms by traditional liberal celebrations of Protestantism. There's a certain self-congratulatory vein of nationalism in some of the historically Protestant countries. It's told by Protestants, by ex-Protestants, some of them secularists who share what is the last really socially acceptable religious prejudice, that is anti-Catholicism. This is an essentially celebratory story of how some Protestants, only some, have defied tyrannical governments in the name of the kingdom of Christ. They've found it in their consciences to resist princes and even to stand in prophetic judgment over them. It's a story that goes back to Martin Luther standing on his conscience and the word of God alone at the Diet of Worms in 1521, defying all the powers of church and empire rather than abandon what he knew to be right. The following year, Luther wrote a treatise titled Temporal Authority, To What Extent It Should Be Obeyed. And he laid out his famous doctrine of the two kingdoms, the kingdom of this world of secular politics and the kingdom of Christ, the realm of the gospel, which transcends the secular world and does not fall under its jurisdiction. This is an immensely powerful idea which has kept resurfacing in different forms throughout Protestant history. It led Luther to argue that rulers cannot compel their subjects' consciences. The conscience is only subject to God. It's with those principles in mind that the Lutheran cities and princes of Germany banded together to defy their emperor, earning themselves the title Protestants in the process, went to war against their sovereign lord, and eventually compelled him to recognize their right to religious freedom. And soon Protestants in France were fighting a series of wars against tyrannical kings, arguing that it would be just to kill a tyrannical ruler. Protestants in Holland overthrew their foreign king and set up a republic committed to at least a measure of religious tolerance. And, of course, when Protestants in England won a bitter war against the misrule, am I allowed to say that in this building, of King Charles I, they sealed their victory by putting him on trial and cutting off his head. King Charles's father, back when he was King James VI of Scotland, had worried that some of his radical Protestant subjects were plotting a democratic form of government, his words. That was an exaggeration. But the leader of Scotland's Reformation, John Knox, had defied a series of rulers with his insistence that, as he put it, all man is equal. It was very clearly men, not women, in a God-given duty to stand up to a tyrant. Knox's successor, Andrew Melville, told King James to his face that while he might be King of Scotland, what truly mattered was the kingdom of Christ, whose subject King James VI is, and of whose kingdom not a king, nor a lord, nor a head, but a member. And it's an easy matter to trace that radical tradition down to our own times. In the later 17th century, John Locke called for religious tolerance on the basis that governments have no authority over their subjects' souls. Evangelical campaigners in Britain and America in the later 18th century began to argue that slavery was incompatible with Christianity, and they pursued dogged and ultimately successful campaigns to abolish it. Many 19th century Protestants embraced liberalism and democracy, even as the leadership of the contemporary Catholic Church set its face firmly against modernist evils of that kind. And in the 20th century, you can find Protestants in a series of radical, anti-fascist, anti-racist, anti-imperialist movements, from post-First World War Korea through the Confessing Church during the Third Reich, through to the Southern Christian Leadership Conference of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King. A tradition which reached its modern apotheosis in the campaign against apartheid in South Africa, in which the leadership of Protestant ministers like Beyers Naudé, Desmond Tutu, and Alan Bosack was decisive, and which produced in the Belhar Confession and the Kairos Document developed theological statements of what this politically and socially radical Protestantism could mean. As it's usually told, this is a celebratory story. It allows Protestants to feel good about themselves, and it allows secular modern liberals to feel that Protestantism was an important developmental stage, which they've now outgrown, but they remember with a certain respectful, if slightly wary, gratitude. But if that story is not to your taste, there is an alternative. This is the story of authoritarian Protestantism, suborned by or actively assisting state power. Again, it begins with Luther, who, having defied the German emperor, was all too ready to claim almost unlimited God-given power for his own political allies. And he was ready to tear up conventional Christian morality to accommodate them, as famously when he decided that one of his most important princely supporters could be allowed a bigamous marriage. And if Luther's political and marital theology were at least ambiguous, that is not a compliment we can extend to King Henry VIII of England, who was no Protestant, but most English Protestants of the time were willing to swallow their principles for the sake of an alliance with him. The authoritarian streak in Protestantism runs from those beginnings through John Calvin's notorious execution of the Spanish freethinker Michael Servetus, through Oliver Cromwell's moral authoritarianism and frankly genocidal approach to Irish Catholicism, through the unforgiving social control that New England's Puritans became notorious for, through the effortless apologies for empire and slavery and the consistent opposition to liberal reform that we heard from Protestant establishments right through the 18th and 19th centuries. In the 20th century, you can trace this story through the religious right in the United States, whether the age of classic fundamentalism in the 1920s or the culture war religious conservatism of our own times. And other highlights include the Dutch Reformed Church in South Africa, whose theology of human distinctiveness was such a crucial underpinning for apartheid. But of course, its pinnacle is the deep involvement of German Protestants in legitimizing and enabling the Nazi regime. In Germany, by that era, Luther's doctrine of the two kingdoms had morphed into an insistence that the church could not have any serious voice in the secular realm. Karl Barth, Nazism's most distinguished theological opponent, wrote that the two kingdoms doctrine lies like a cloud over the thinking and action of more or less every course taken by the German church. Dietrich Bonhoeffer, Protestant anti-Nazism's greatest martyr, likewise blamed German Protestants' reluctance to defy the Nazis on a fatal humility before the secular power. When the regime gave evil orders, he wrote, Germans obeyed with an irresponsible unscrupulousness, scarcely bothering to consult their consciences. But if they ever considered defiance, those same consciences awoke into an agonizing scrupulosity, which invariably frustrated action. Either way, the result was the same, submission and obedience. So, depending on whether you want Protestant heroes or villains, and on what political or religious agenda you yourself may be trying to sell, you pays your money and you takes your choice. This is a very appealing double story. It's got a lot of truth in it, but it's not adequate. It comforts various modern myths while failing to understand the real power of Protestantism's political impact. It doesn't just miss a large part of what the Reformation was about. I think it misunderstands how it's shaping the world in our own times. At worst, these twin stories can seem constructed in order to distract us from a point that should be inescapable. Protestantism is not a political movement. It is about God, and it is about human salvation. The centrality of those spiritual concerns has often been exasperating to secular politicians who want to work with Protestants and are frustrated by all the wearisome Jesus talk. But it is unavoidable. Naturally, Protestants' spiritual preoccupations have political consequences, sometimes dramatic ones, when an overwhelming encounter with God has turned your world upside down. Nothing, including politics, is going to be quite the same. But if we misread those secondary effects as primary, we will not be able to understand their impact. A subplot of the larger drama won't make sense to you unless you see its place in the main story. Even at the most politically charged moments, you can see Protestants setting off at right angles to secular political debates. For example, in the United States, before their Civil War, one theme that repeatedly surfaced amongst Protestants who were unwaveringly opposed to slavery was that slavery was not the most important question. Abolitionist campaigners were pressuring missionaries to the Native Americans to denounce the slavery practiced by, amongst others, the Cherokee and the Choctaw. The missionaries refused, on the grounds that while they loathed slavery, such denunciation would result in them being thrown out and would bring their mission to an abrupt end. They were willing to tolerate a worldly evil in order to save souls. Or consider the free African-American revivalist preacher Zilpha Elliott. She certainly condemned slavery. She occasionally attended abolitionist meetings. But it was not her dominating concern. In 1828, she recorded in her diary meeting another preacher, himself a slave. And she wrote rather disdainfully that this man seemed to manifest an undue anxiety for his freedom. Although, she told her diary, the Bible told slaves to be content with their condition, this man anxiously sighed for liberty. The following week, in her diary, she recorded happily that his prayers had been answered. In the same week, she said, he was taken ill and finally fell asleep in Jesus, departing to be where the wicked cease from troubling and the weary are at rest. Now, this is the kind of attitude that infuriated abolitionist critics of conventional Christianity, who despaired at the way promises of heaven were used to keep slaves quiescent. But if, as Elor did, you believe that this life is a passing shadow and that humanity's only true happiness lies in God, her approach is not illogical. She is a clue to a hidden strand of Protestant apoliticism. Once again, this goes back to Luther, although Luther is only reviving a strand of Christian political theology which is there in the New Testament. Luther's view on princes in his book on temporal authority is hardly idealistic. This is what he says about them. They can do no more than strip and fleece, heap tax upon tax. Since the beginning of the world, a wise prince is a mighty rare bird, and an upright prince even rarer. They're generally the biggest fools or the worst scoundrels on earth. But this was not a call to arms. In his view, God permits these scoundrels to rule because the world is too wicked and does not deserve to have many wise or upright princes. God had instituted human government, and Luther was very clear that God had done so, not to make the world perfect, not even to make it better, simply to impose a minimal restraint on human evil and to make a limited semblance of peace and order possible. His point, it's a point that is deeply counterintuitive to most modern sensibilities, is that government is not very important. It's necessary in a humdrum way for as long as this passing world endures, but Christians shouldn't pay too much attention to it. Instead, their hearts should be set on the kingdom of Christ, where there's no law and no coercion and which is not passing away. Now, I called this apoliticism. The long-standing accusation is that that's a polite word simply for submission to tyrannical rulers. And it's true that the two can look pretty similar. The apolitical ethic is one which the first generation of Protestant princes and a series of more or less unpleasant rulers ever since have happily encouraged. Because, of course, to be deliberately apolitical is to give tacit support to whoever happens to be in power. But even in the first generation, there were indications that withdrawal from the political realm in this way need not be simply submission in fancy dress. Mennonites and others in the Anabaptist tradition, for example, mixed scrupulous obedience with fastidious refusal to be involved in or contaminated by political life in any way, which included embracing a radical pacifism. The reasoning behind that position is similar to Luther's. It leads to a very different position. A truer, a more subversive descendant of Luther's position is Philip Jakob Spener. He's a decisive figure in Protestantism's history who's now largely forgotten, but he's the founding father of Pietism, the movement which gave rise to modern evangelicalism. His manifesto of 1675, Pious Desires, nowadays reads as a bland collection of truisms. No revolutionary manifesto has ever been so reassuring, until you notice its ringing silence on one central issue. In his vision of godly society, there is no mention of government at all. The revolutionary power of Pietism and Methodism and Evangelicalism came from their willingness and their ability simply to bypass political structures, sending books and preachers promiscuously across borders and sparking lay-led revivals which did not wait for political permission. The English Marxist historian E.P. Thompson famously argued that the reason England didn't have a revolution like France did in the late 18th century is that Methodism diverted working class energies into religious renewal. He meant that as a criticism, of course. But if that's where some of the English working class sought and found their salvation, it does seem presumptuous to say that they were wrong. And while it's true that Methodism didn't threaten the British state, it was equally not subordinate to it. But, of course, it was in the United States where something pretty like Luther's Two Kingdoms doctrine was written into the Constitution that Protestant apoliticism really came into its own. By 1850, a third of the entire population of the Republic, slave and free, were Methodists. A constant keynote of the many new Protestant movements of America's 19th century was a refusal to become involved in worldly politics in any way, whether by sort of a pragmatic and flexible withdrawal or a rigid and doctrinaire separation, as in the case of the Jehovah's Witnesses. Many Protestants who remained in the historic churches shared this same ethos. The Holiness Methodists of the late 19th century had their hearts set on sanctification and empowerment by the Holy Spirit, not on a political scene consumed by arguments about the gold standard. The Pentecostalism that erupted in the first decade of the 20th century wasn't opposed to politics so much as profoundly uninterested in it, a rotten business generally not worth Christians' attention. The historian Lawrence Moore says that even during the traumatic global upheavals of the 1930s and 40s, if you were to only read Pentecostal periodicals, you would have got no sense that any events took place in the world other than the wonder-working, soul-saving miracles of the Holy Ghost. Early Pentecostals didn't believe it was wrong to vote. When a moral issue such as prohibition was at stake, they did. But generally, they believed that the corruption and compromises of worldly politics offered nothing of any real value to God's people. It's a view recognizably similar to Luther's. The kingdom of this world is legitimate, it just doesn't matter very much. If you want to see the contrast between this kind of apolitical Protestantism and the more conventionally political kind in miniature, I would point you to South Korea, the first Asian country to see large-scale conversions to Protestantism. In the 1970s, a group of radical Korean Presbyterians developed a so-called theology of the Minjong. This is a Korean word meaning roughly the poor and the oppressed. It attracted worldwide attention from liberal Protestants who were excited by its possibilities. The Korean Christian Declaration of 1973 explained that Minjong theology aimed to follow in the footsteps of our Lord, living among the oppressed and poor, standing against political oppression and participating in the transformation of history, for this is the only way to the messianic kingdom. Now, during the dictatorship of Park Chung-hee, those were not cheap sentiments. Christian dissidents influenced by this movement were prominent in opposing the dictatorship. Many of them suffered lengthy terms of imprisonment as a result. During the height of this movement, in the early and mid-70s, the small Presbyterian church which openly embraced it saw its membership rise by some 11%. But during the same years, the membership of Korea's main Presbyterian denominations, which actively distanced themselves from politics, rose by 70% or more. The irony of the Minjung theologians is that they didn't attract much interest from the poor and the oppressed themselves. In fact, by the time democracy was eventually established in South Korea, this movement had come to be seen as patriarchal and rather nationalist. But also its willingness to flirt with Marxism was unappealing to Christians living next door to a heavily armed Stalinist dictatorship. The supposedly apolitical majority amongst Protestants were accused of in fact giving comfort to the Park regime. The regime certainly wooed them. Members of the government, on one occasion even Park himself, attended prayer breakfasts hosted by sympathetic pastors. But few Korean Protestants seem to have been active supporters. According to a revealing survey of Korean Protestants from 1982, only 6% believed that churches should actively and collectively oppose human rights violations. But the number who denied that such problems existed were equally tiny, or that they were important. 32% felt that the churches should respond through criticism and evangelism, trying to infuse gospel values through Korean society. And 43%, by far the largest group, recommended responding to these troubles chiefly with prayer, which is a stance that looks contemptibly weak only if you assume that prayer is not an effective means of intervening in worldly affairs. In the same survey, 89% of Korean Protestants claimed to expect Christ's second coming very soon. Their theology told them to expect the world to grow worse, and so working to improve it was futile. One of the key leaders of that small radical church claimed that a church should be an organization of strength, awakening each citizen to a sense of sovereignty and letting him speak. But to most Korean Protestants, while that might be an admirable sentiment, it didn't sound much like a church. They tended to think that churches were there to win converts and save souls, and that they were doing at an unprecedented rate. The proportion of Protestants in the South Korean population rose from 2.5% in 1960 to as high as 27% in 1990. Almost all of that growth was in the rigorously conservative, apolitical evangelical churches. And that boom mirrored, in fact, tracks spookily closely the equally astonishing economic boom of the same years. It was the misfortune of the Minjung theologians to be preaching justice for the poor at a time and place when the condition of the poor was changing faster than had ever been seen before in human history. The most dynamic growth in the Korean churches came, in fact, from churches such as the famous Yoido Full Gospel Church, now the world's largest congregation, which preached a so-called prosperity gospel, offering material wealth as a gift of the Holy Spirit. In the middle of an economic boom, which even secular economists were calling a miracle, all that the Minjung theologians could offer to the poor was dignity. The prosperity gospel not only offered, but apparently delivered a chance to stop being poor. That Korean pattern, in which apoliticism looks like a code for supporting right-wing governments, has parallels around the world. In Chile, during the presidency of the socialist Salvador Allende, a survey found that 60% of Pentecostals believed that political participation doesn't really lead anywhere. Pentecostals were less likely than the general population to be interested in politics or to read newspapers. But after Augusto Pinochet's coup in 1973, a joint declaration by 32 Chilean Pentecostal and evangelical denominations stated that Pinochet's accession to power was God's answer to the prayers of all the believers who recognized that Marxism is an expression of satanic power. Pinochet used the huge Pentecostal Methodist Church in Santiago as the site for his annual National Thanksgiving service. He even asked its pastor to serve as a minister in his government. I think it's significant that he refused. So the case for the prosecution is that this apoliticism is a sham. It systematically favours oppressive and authoritarian governments. The presumption that politics is rotten is itself inherently right-wing, since many left-wing politics depend on active government intervention. In a survey in 2014, nearly twice as many Catholics as Protestants in Latin America thought that it was important to lobby for government activity to support the poor. And somewhat more Catholics than Protestants, it's 50% against 37%, emphasised the importance of charitable support for the poor. Whereas twice as many Protestants as Catholics argued that the best way to help the poor was to bring them to Christ. So on this reading, apolitical withdrawal is code for collaboration with right-wing American neocolonialism. I think the tone of accusation behind that claim is interesting in itself. Since the French Revolution, or thereabouts, most European and European-derived societies have shared a belief which is rather peculiar in long historical perspective. We've believed that most human problems are susceptible of political solutions. This very modern faith in the gospel of politics has been vindicated by some spectacular successes and has survived some catastrophic failures. One consequence of this is our belief that mass political participation is a virtue. Hence the common presumption, which on the face of it is a little bit odd, that voting as such is morally superior to not voting, regardless of who or what you vote for. We once fretted about how few people turn up to church, now we fret about how few people turn out to vote. And in that context, apoliticism looks deeply irresponsible. In 1986, the Brazilian Anglican future bishop, Robinson Cavalcanti, said that the irrelevance of Protestantism is so great that if the rapture occurred today, Brazilian society would take a week to notice that the believers were no longer there. It seemed to him self-evident that this was a criticism. But for many centuries, Christians who aspired to withdraw from the world the better to seek God would have taken that as praise. But in fact, Protestant apoliticism has more to it than simple submission. In modern times, avowedly apolitical Protestants have been stirred into political action when faced with movements or ideologies that they see as existential threats, whether that's Marxism in Latin America, political Islam in contemporary Nigeria, imperial Shintoism in Japanese-occupied Korea and China. But equally, they've sometimes been able to negotiate amicable coexistence with these movements. In the 1980s, most Pentecostal leaders in Nicaragua, one of the most Protestant countries in Latin America, loudly denounced the American-backed Contra rebels. They proclaimed their apolitical stance and their avowed loyalty to their Marxist government, much to the surprise and frustration of many in America's religious right. The chief concern of Nicaraguan Protestants was neither revolution nor counter-revolution, but to preach and enact their gospel. For their part, as one scholar puts it, the Nicaraguan government found it hard to understand why, at a time when the poor needed to defend their gains against the United States and counter-revolution, so many were spending their nights clapping and singing, to no apparent purpose. But it was harmless, and so the regime was willing to let it happen. It's that demand that the kingdom of Christ be allowed to govern its own realm that has been apolitical Protestants' key non-negotiable political demand since the 16th century. It's limited and it's self-centered. It doesn't pay much attention to wider social questions. And in that case, these are people whose loyalty a government can buy cheaply. But there have always been governments which are unable or unwilling to make that bargain. In the People's Republic of China, avowedly and painstakingly apolitical Protestants were curtailed and eventually suppressed in the 1950s and 60s. Since the re-legalization of public worship in China in 1979, a large majority of Chinese Protestants have refused to join the officially recognized Protestant church. These unregistered churches are typically scrupulous about avoiding political activism of any kind, but the mere insistence on carving out a space where the Communist Party's writ does not run is itself a highly political act. Nor is it a surprise that the crackdown on both registered and unregistered churches in China since 2013 has led these punctiliously apolitical Protestants to stiffen their response, using the courts and the internet to stand up as best they can to defend the borders of their realm. But the canonical modern example of this kind of apolitical Protestantism is the Confessing Church in Nazi Germany. We now remember the Confessing Church as the anti-Nazi wing of Protestantism, but the heroism of leaders like Barth and Bonhoeffer set them apart. In general, the Confessing Church offered very little real resistance to the Nazi state. They did undertake cautious, measured, and not ineffective lobbying against the systematic murder of the disabled and the chronically ill. And that makes their near-total silence on the genocide that was unfolding around them all the starker. The Confessing Church's most important leader, Martin Niemöller, is best known now for his confession made after the war that he was silent when Jews and communists and trade unionists were taken, so that when he was taken, no one was left to speak for him. And that is not an unfair representation of the stance of the Confessing Church as a whole. What it did, or tried to do, was to defend its own freedom to decide its own doctrine, worship, and polity, including its right to treat Christians of Jewish descent as full and equal members of the church, right up to the moment when they were rounded up. It wasn't heroic, but it wasn't craven either. Niemöller didn't spend 8 years in a concentration camp because he lacked principles. And indeed, it's worth noticing that the Christian group which offered the most steadfast resistance to the Nazis, the group which in 1937 managed in one night to distribute across Germany 300,000 copies of a secretly printed pamphlet denouncing Hitler as the apocalyptic beast, this is also the most doggedly apolitical of them all, the Jehovah's Witnesses. So these apolitical Protestants cannot tolerate, because they can't be tolerated by, totalitarianisms of any kind, whether communist, fascist, or theocratic. They can tolerate authoritarian governments that are willing to leave them alone. And the fact that in recent times right-wing authoritarians have been more willing to do that than left-wing ones doesn't make them friends of right-wing authoritarianism. They do have some genuine affinity with the democratic centre-right. There's a shared emphasis on self-help, private initiative, individual moral renewal, and a suspicion for state enterprise. But there's also an affinity with the modern democratic centre-left. There's a shared emphasis on human equality and a strong suspicion of nationalism. I think the struggle in Latin America between Pentecostalism and Marxism is instructive. Marxism calls the poor to struggle for a future revolution, which is defined as a public event. It tends to spread in workplaces and in other public spheres, and it tends to be led by men. Pentecostalism offers not a chance to sacrifice yourself for a future revolution, but immediate and practical spiritual help, whether that's moral renewal in the face of gangs, drugs, and violence, through promised miracles of healing and deliverance, to the material benefits offered by the prosperity gospel. It spreads in the private sphere through households and families, very often through women's agency. And it offers solutions across the broad front of the everyday troubles that dominate most human lives. Of course, in practice, it doesn't solve all of these problems all of the time, but it does it enough that the offer works, and certainly does so more reliably than any secular political utopia. And it does, or it can, mobilize initiative. I quoted earlier that 2014 survey showing that more Catholics than Protestants in Latin America approve of charitable work to help the poor. The same survey showed that many more Protestants than Catholics actually do it themselves. One final example, which I've referred to a couple of times already. Apartheid-era South Africa. The historically white-led mainline Protestant churches were divided by the end of the apartheid era into openly pro and anti camps. Most of the so-called African independent churches, the largest, the fastest growing segment of South African Protestantism, did not engage. Sometimes this amounted to support for the regime. The largest of these independent churches, the Zion Christian Church, invited President P.W. Botha to speak at Easter 1985. This is at the height of the civil disobedience campaign. They even invested him with a church honour. Some of that church's ministers accepted roles in the puppet governments of the so-called homelands. At the Post-Apartheid Truth and Reconciliation Commission, one prominent independent church leader came forward to ask forgiveness for not having fought in the struggle, for not having been beaten up, detained, and killed. We are cowards, and we admit it. But others were less apologetic. The Zion Christian Church's testimony to the commission emphasized that it had defied apartheid by teaching its members to respect themselves, one another, and the law. They were not to hurt others, but to refuse to be hurt by others. That was at least speaking the commission's language. Another major independent church, the Nazaretha Church, struck a different note. Its formal submission to the commission testified that when confronted by oppression, all they had to do was to ask the congregation to kneel down and have izigukwa, which is a special prayer to God. This was the kind of talk which led politicized Protestants to despair that the independent churches were only ever going to offer supernatural placebos, rather than providing what one black South African theologian called the kind of political direction which the black community needs. When the country's main English-speaking churches produced the Kairos document, a stirring theological declaration of the evils of apartheid in 1985, the independent churches, which by then accounted for about a third of South Africa's entire population, were neither included in the process nor mentioned in the finished document. The independent churches replied that providing political direction was not their purpose. What the black community truly needed, in their view, was not mobilization but help in the midst of this world's troubles. As a more sympathetic black South African theologian, Simon Mamela, pointed out, the establishment churches had much to say to people about the distant hope of political liberation, but little about what he called their daily misfortunes, illness, encounter with evil and witchcraft, bad luck, poverty, barrenness, in short, all their concrete social problems, which the independent churches positively encouraged people to bring to church. The establishment churches were learning how to defy evil. The independents were offering to defeat it. I'm conscious that I'm starting to sound like I'm banging the drum for Protestant apoliticism. I'm not, or not exactly. I do think it's a phenomenon that's been misunderstood, but I am not an apolitical Protestant. I'm a paid-up member of the chattering classes. I'm an enthusiastic to obsessive consumer of news. I don't believe I've ever missed an opportunity to vote in my life, including police and crime commissioners. More to the point, it doesn't seem to me that in the face of what some governments inflict on their populations, merely defending the sovereignty of your own sphere is sufficient, although those are cheap words. But I've not dwelt on this phenomenon this evening simply to describe it. It does seem to me that for all its problems, it contains a little bit of countercultural wisdom that our age could do with hearing. The view that worldly politics is not very important is unfashionable, at least among the middle classes, but it's not ridiculous. It seems to me that if you can err between placing too much and not enough significance on politics, it seems clear to me which way we lean. At the least, it's salutary for people like me to recognize that our obsessive news consumption is somewhere between a hobby and an addiction rather than a virtue. Very large numbers of people in our societies, of course, pay only very intermittent attention to public affairs, and that too may have a wisdom in it. Naturally, there are times and places where the moral imperative to attend intensely to public affairs is overwhelming. But happily, those circumstances are rare. This country has not seen them in my lifetime. As for those of us who do remain incorrigibly interested in political life, well, you may perhaps have noticed that liberal democracy in the West is going through a bit of a rough patch. The old faith in the gospel of politics looks a little threadbare. The claim that politics is an inherently corrupt and rotten business with little power to effect real change in ordinary people's lives is starting in some circles to sound less like a theological proposition and more like a self-evident truth. Our system, of course, allows us to replace one set of politicians with another, but it's harder to change the political culture. Whoever you elect, the government always gets in. This is, of course, a thoroughly malign set of circumstances. It threatens to give us as it's already doing in many parts of the world, a politics of scapegoating, in which outsiders to the political scene seek power by making unfulfillable promises and then try to hold it by blaming their opponents for their own failure. But it's also very much the kind of environment in which apolitical Protestantism has been quietly putting down roots across the world in the past half century. So how might this play out? Well, of course, if apolitical Protestantism were to thrive in this kind of environment, that could easily make things worse. It could encourage what might otherwise be an energetic and morally engaged sector of society to withdraw into the private sphere. But it's good to end a lecture like this on an optimistic note. So let me suggest two good things that this tradition could bring to our modern predicaments. Not too much of it, but just a salting. One is that there might be some contribution to the renewal of our political culture. Historically, one of the ways in which periods of political corruption and dysfunction and loss of direction have been brought to an end is by a remoralization of public life. It seems interesting to me that as Pentecostals have begun to step tentatively into politics in Latin America and in Africa, they've usually done so by promising to move their countries neither to the left nor to the right, but towards heaven, to renew the moral cultures of their countries, in particular by promising to elect individuals of irreproachable personal ethics and by campaigns against corruption. I hardly need to tell you how obvious the problems with this kind of approach are. I don't so much mean that the moral agendas of these sorts of campaigns may extend to questions like gender and sexuality, which will be unwelcome in a pluralist society, because this sort of apolitical Protestantism tends to be more interested in preserving its own distinctive holiness than in imposing norms on the rest of society. The problem is more simply that the track record of these attempts at political remoralization are dismal. From Zambia to Cote d'Ivoire to Brazil, the story of the last decade or two has been the same. Hypocrisy is easily mistaken for piety. Piety is a poor substitute for competence, and power tends to corrupt. But moral renewal in political life isn't impossible. It's just difficult. It has happened before in many different contexts. Our own situation, of course, is not, as is often said, that we're in a society that lacks a shared moral agenda or a shared moral compass. We have a very clear and very strong unifying moral story that we tell each other in this country, and that story is essentially the Second World War. That's become the dominant moral narrative of our times. And it gives us a very clear and very widely agreed sense of what evil is. What it hasn't given us is a shared vision of what good is, of what we ought to be moving towards rather than simply what we ought to be avoiding. It seems to me that our transactional and increasingly rudderless political culture is going to find a new moral or ideological compass at some point. I don't know whether it will be this one, but there are many worse options available. And of course, the other thing that Protestant apoliticism could, if just mixed into the whole lump, give to our own times, is some perspective. It could remind us that a very large part of human misery, and especially of human flourishing, lies beyond the power of any government. In 2010, the Nigerian preacher Sam Adeyemi argued, "People make government too powerful in our country. They do not realize that the most powerful form of government is self-government." You don't have to accept his strong view of the empowerment of the Holy Spirit or his despair at the prospects for meaningful political change in his particular context to accept that in general the salvation which the gospel of politics can offer us is strictly limited. Too strident, too messianic, or too apocalyptic a faith in it isn't just inimical to human flourishing in general, but to political life in particular, because it demands and expects of politicians far more than they can ever deliver. There are better responses to the ills of our age than impotent rage at a ruling class. There are more adult responses. As we trace and retrace the vicious and infantilizing circle from entitlement to resentment to helplessness and back to the start again, It may be that a gospel which offers empowerment instead will find that it has a part to play. Thank you.
Professor Ryrie has kindly said he will take questions and comments, and I'm sure there will be some. Just to give you a chance to formulate your questions and the roving mic a chance to get itself set up, may I just kick off with one possible question,
please,
which you can bat aside straight away if you like. I wouldn't venture to give a fourth narrative to your three, you know, positive, negative, and apolitical. But as possibly a different perspective on all those, most likely on the first, I wonder whether you would also agree that there is a narrative that can be told of the way that, broadly speaking, the Protestant valuing of individual conscience, of individual access to ideas, to texts, its wariness of hierarchy, its valuing of so-called ordinary people and ordinary life, all these great themes, which do have a theological basis, have actually, even if not in an intended way, had the consequence of breaking open hegemony, helping, as one major cause, to value plurality, diversity, freedoms, which we take for granted in modern liberalism. In other words, Protestantism has actually had an effect on helping to produce liberalism. Is that a fair sort of narrative, even if it's not entirely intended by Protestantism?
Well, I'm going to say yes, but I'm afraid. It is. That I think you can clearly draw that as a line of unintended consequences. And not entirely unintended. I mean, some of those conclusions are being drawn right at the beginning. Luther himself is very wary of extrapolating any sorts of social or political consequences from what he saw as a strictly spiritual message of liberation. But there are people, you know, right in that first generation who, and this is why Germany has, in the Peasants' War in 1524-25, the largest mass uprising in European history before the French Revolution. Well, that's at least part of the reason why that happens. So that radically corrosive approach to human differentiation and the insistence that everybody stands equally before God is there, and a lot of my first tradition is driven by that insight. I think it's also there in my apoliticals as well, because what's driving their insistence that the sphere of politics simply doesn't apply to them within their the life of the church is that insistence that the kingdom of Christ works in a fundamentally different way, that in that different terrain we all stand equally before God. The part of the story that you're telling that I think we need to be careful of is the suggestion that this necessarily leads to pluralism, to tolerance, to acceptance of difference. Protestantism does get there, but it tends to get there once by having exhausted all the other alternatives first. The discovery of tolerance as a positive virtue, which is starting to move from the margins to the mainstream by the end of the 17th century, is chiefly a matter of exhaustion. This is the point by which most Europeans have realized that the prospect of forcible conversion of one kind or another, whether we're actually talking about full-scale persecution or imposing crippling civil disabilities on religious minorities, just isn't going to work. These people aren't going away, and instead the amount of diversity is increasing, and it becomes necessary to begin to see that as a virtue rather than as a necessity. But that's a long and painful process.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Now, clearly two questions already. We'll take this gentleman first and then second there. And open it up.
Thank you very much indeed. It was a fascinating lecture. Can I just suggest that maybe what you said applies more to Pietists and Pentecostals than to Protestants as a whole. How do you fit the Protestant propensity to generate moral crusades into your analysis? I'm thinking of the Society of the Suppression of Vice, the campaign against slavery, prohibition in America, temperance movement in Britain, the nonconformist conscience, nonconformists supporting Gladstone, things like the Bulgarian atrocities, the campaign against Rome on the rates, church schools, in recent times, the campaign against marriage equality, abortion, the moral majority in America. It seems to me that Protestants have been ready to enter the political sphere when they've seen what they thought of as a moral issue. I mean, the social gospel, Walter Rauschenbusch, all this sort of thing. How do you fit that into your analysis?
Thank you very much. That's really important to raise. I would, because of course there have been a great many of the of these sorts of movements. I'd want to divide them up though into different kinds of intervention. There's a whole set that you could fit under the social gospel umbrella, and you can stretch that definition back and forward in time. And there are right wing and there are left wing versions of it, which are attempting to create a Protestant model of one kind or another for the society as a whole. And that firmly belongs in one or other of my first two narratives. You can place each one wherever you prefer. You also have a series of movements which are more individually focused. And I would put the classic temperance movements, you know, as an obvious example of this, which begin as movements within the churches that start as being less about imposing a model on the whole of society, but differentiating yourself, differentiating the purified ethics of a particular community from the sink of corruption that they're in the midst of, and that sort of withdrawalist approach to reforming movements. One of the really interesting things about this is the point at which those sorts of movements reach a scale at which they tip over, and it starts to become impossible for a movement which has tried to look after simply its own community to ignore the fact that it's becoming socially dominant. And the prospect of reaching out beyond that is clear. And I think you're seeing that in some of the places, even where Pietists and Pentecostals have become involved in political leadership, the way that Frederick Chiluba, the Pentecostal president of Zambia, tried to changed the constitution to declare that Zambia was a Christian country. And saw embracing a structural adjustment program as an act of collective national repentance. So there's an extent to which that kind of limited reformist movement finds it difficult to stay within those limits under some circumstances. Spilling over into more active political involvement can't be avoided. It does seem to me that that's secondary in a lot of cases. But thank you.
I'm of the view that a nation gets the government that it deserves, which means it reflects the hearts and minds of the people of that nation. Do you have any views on this, my thoughts?
Well, of course, there are two ways of arguing that. There's the modern democratic approach that, you know, democracy gives the people what they deserve and gives it to them good and hard. Or there's Luther's approach, which goes back to Augustine and to a lot of classic Christian political theology, which is that we should regard wicked, unjust, or inept governments not as an occasion for rebellion, but as a punishment from God, and therefore that the response should not be to rise up against them, but to repent. I don't think that works very well in a democratic political culture, however much sense it might have made in some previous eras. Whether we always get the government we deserve. Well, let's just say that I have a higher opinion of the United States of America than that might imply.
Yes, William, here, in the front row.
Thank you, that was brilliant. But just to take on the last point you left with, it seems to me that in all sorts of ways the obvious gap in your talk was Donald Trump, because here is somebody who's been elected by a group of broadly apolitical Protestants who have a very poor view of politicians, which he conforms to absolutely, and who want the state to diminish and to leave them alone, and so they can have church prayer, they can have prayers in school so that they can oppose gay marriage and they can do all these sorts of things. And the fact that he was brought up as part of a prosperity gospel church only makes that easier. And in a way, doesn't apolitical Protestantism, isn't the answer to that? The third of the outcomes is Donald Trump. I mean, that's exactly what you'd expect apolitical Protestantism to produce. I mean, more orange, maybe, but otherwise that's essentially what apolitical Protestantism gives you, doesn't it?
It can do. But you may think I'm whistling in the wind, but I have a more optimistic reading of it, and let me try it out and see if I can get to the end of this without the place dissolving into laughter. The hopeful sign that I draw from what is happening in the United States at the moment is that it seems to me that the religious right is entering the same crisis that the American religious left entered 40 years ago. By allying itself too closely and too unconditionally to a political movement and subordinating its spiritual concerns to political concerns, it loses its reason to continue to exist as anything other than a political movement. Maybe I'm over-optimistically reading early signs of the bubbling crisis on the religious right in America, but especially there seems to be a real generational shift emerging there between those who have been really remarkably willing to throw aside a great number of specific and long declared political principles, religious and moral principles, in order to continue embracing the political movement they've supported for a long time, and those who aren't. My suspicion, and this may be a fool's hope, is that we will find this movement running into serious trouble as a consequence of that. There is, as you say, a certain strand of hard-headed realism in Christian support for Trump, or actually often less support for Trump as opposition to the Democratic Party's agenda in the United States. That, you know, I've heard the argument that was being circulated last year that supporting Trump was like supporting Constantine as emperor. You may recognize that he's personally depraved, but he's going to defend your interests and sphere better than anything else. My hope and suspicion is that that's not the dominant thing that's going on, and it might also be nice if there was to be some attempt from the other side to poach that kind of view.
Yes, and then the lady here afterwards.
Coming back to your second possible benefit of apolitical Protestantism, I wonder what you feel about another spin on that, or another angle on that, which struck me, which is that in addition to self-respect, that also there's an element of humility, of realism, which can emerge from this approach of saying that politics can't do everything. Because in a way there is arguably something hubristic about thinking that we, and through us politicians, can bring about human flourishing, as you say. And it isn't just that it lies beyond the power of government, but that we need to recognise it lies beyond the power of us as people anyway, that there needs to be some other dimension which is brought in to encourage human flourishing. So that in a sense it's not just self-respect, but also a proper humility and a proper realism, that this narcissistic view that we can do it all ourselves is just not accurate. How do you feel about that?
I'm very happy to agree with that. It seems to me that one of the persistent political problems of most Western political systems of the last 200 years, and this happens on the right and the left in various places, is utopianism of one sort or another. And for all its problems, and there are many, it seems to be one of the values of this approach is that it could scarcely be less utopian.
Lady here. Yeah.
Thank you. I wondered if you thought that the narratives you described had played out in different or the same ways in countries that, following the Reformation, formally adopted Protestant or sort of versions of Protestant religions at a state level?
Yes, is the short answer. It seems to me that you can make quite a clear division between those countries, you know, the Scandinavian kingdoms, most of the German territories, and indeed Britain, where one version or another of Protestantism becomes an established state church, and the alliance with the state is very closely entangled. I mean, we're sitting in one of the most vivid monuments to that entanglement, which has been very fruitful, but has also been problematic. I'm a licensed minister in the Church of England, but I do feel a little uncomfortable when I use the prayer book service. And there's a great deal of prayer for Queen and government. There isn't a hint of recognition in the liturgy that government might potentially sometimes be a bad thing. It seems to me that in this country we've avoided the worst traps of my second approach, the sort of narrative of submission, surprisingly well. The Scots have avoided it better. But that's the tendency in which the gravity pulls. Whereas in those other settings where Protestantism has had to fight for its existence, of course, Scotland, the story starts that way. Maybe that's why that story is different. That legacy hangs on. I mean, the Netherlands is maybe the most obvious example for that, which has an established Protestant church after the success of the Dutch revolt, but never a clear Protestant majority, always maintains a degree of tolerance, can be overdone, but nevertheless, and finds itself as a plural society in which, withdrawal into the private sphere and the separation of the religious sphere from the public sphere becomes a very obvious option early on. It's not uncontested, but it's there.
Yes, we do have time for at least one, possibly two. So, gentlemen, right beside you there.
Thank you. You concluded your lecture this evening talking that perhaps in the modern narrative we were clear of the horrors of the Second World War and National Socialism. Mm-hmm. But perhaps the alternatives are not so clear in terms of our direction. As a historian myself, I'm wondering if when Martin Luther was nailing the proclamation, or perhaps an English Protestant jettisoning some of the baubles of Catholicism, were they equally clear at that time, anti-Catholicism clear, but alternatives less clear?
That's a very good point. I think in Luther's case, when he was making his first protest, he was clear neither about where he was going nor about what he was leaving behind. You know, if you read the 95 Theses, they're a very strange and ambiguous document. He's making this stuff up as he goes along. Nevertheless, I think by the time he is forced under heavy fire to work out more clearly what his position is, he has a clearer sense of direction and comes to see Catholicism as the antithesis of all that, and indeed the Pope himself as Antichrist, because of the Church's refusal to accept what for him is the key, the overwhelming question, the entire summary of the gospel, which is his understanding of salvation. I mean, for him, that's what drives everything. That's what leads him to reject the authority of the church and to insist on scripture alone as the only basis. Different Protestants do it different ways, as they do with everything. So that variety, and indeed that inability to share a common notion of the good in the public sphere, becomes an important part of it. So you can make a good case for saying this is a problem that Protestantism, because of its fragmented nature, is ill-equipped to solve. Still, it seems to me that there have been times, especially with some of the reforming movements that our friend over here was talking about, where there has been a more positive collective, sometimes a negative collective reforming agenda, a vision for what a society ought to be or what a godly community ought to be, which is the kind of vision that we do not have collectively at present. I would hate to see the process of our trying to agree on one. But the process of trying to get by without one may turn out to be problematic as well.
Thank you. I think on that call for envisioning a positive vision, we must bring this to a close. In thanking Professor Ryrie, it seems to me that it's been quite brave and bracing to be standing here in Westminster talking about how inessential politics is. Quite brave on the anniversary of Luther to be saying how he got his two kingdoms quite wrong. I do agree entirely with that. To be more serious, I mean, what we've had, of course, is some extraordinarily well-informed and acute historical perspective. Some very, very well-grounded theological perspective. And interestingly, and perhaps less usually, but so importantly, we've had this global perspective. We've been taken out of our own small place here into a much wider canvas, but then also all those threads brought back to challenge us about our vision in the current crisis of modern democracy. That is a tour de force. We are very grateful. Thank you.